So welcome. Takes a little bit of time. There it goes. Okay, so welcome. It's my first time using this contraption, so it's a little disorienting. I feel like I'm in a Star Trek movie with this headgear on. So tonight I'd like to talk about turning toward the difficult. All right. So I started off my practice in the midst of difficulty. This is about 18 years ago. I just was going through the middle of a divorce. And that period of time was probably the most difficult period of my life, when the world felt very shattered. The very ground that I took as being solid was shaking under my feet. And so, you know, that heartache, that heartbreaking time, it was very difficult. And in the midst of that, then I first heard the Dharma. I was first introduced to the words of the Dharma. And in that those words, I really heard a different way to relate to this difficulty. And instead of trying to blame her, or blaming myself, or blaming the circumstances, but really taking a very different task to it, one of turning toward the difficulty, to actually looking to see that my resistance toward my experience was the cause of my suffering. Even though this is a very difficult situation, it was how much I was adding to that. There was an optional quality to that. And so that really resonated deeply, this different way of relating to a difficult situation. Now at that time I just started practicing, so meditation is very new to me. And so this idea of turning toward the difficult, looking at resistance and releasing that resistance, was very conceptual for me. But at the same time, I'd also been very intensely involved in two other practices. One was Aikido. And so Aikido, there's this way that we learn how to deal with conflict, to deal with physical aggression, physical collision, and learning what that really feels like in a very somatic, very body-centered way, and learning how to blend with that, how to stay centered and in flow with that. So that informed this idea of going from resistance to non-resistance very deeply in an embodied felt way. Also at the same time, I was also involved in some intensive group therapy, you know, looking at some of the deep patterns, the conditioning, patterns of dysfunction, you know, learning how to relate to them in a very different way. And again, taking full responsibility for my own experience, my own thoughts, my own feelings, you know, exploring the emotions, the mistaken beliefs, in a very direct, in a very embodied way, and with a compassionate support. So in that process, I really learned this way of being very courageous with the parts of me that I didn't like, that I judged, that I kept hidden. This deep intention to turn toward those, to actually use those as a way to understanding my patterns and to have a sense of freedom from that. You know, questioning these deep assumptions I had taken. So at those times, both Aikido and this group therapy helped me keep working on my edges, both physically, emotionally, energetically, mentally. And then introducing this idea of the Dharma, of that resistance is the cause of suffering. You know, that gave it an embodied way to work with it, reframed it. And so as we practice, it's really vitally important that each of our practices is very grounded in our body, that we do have this sense of embodiment, that it's not an intellectual exercise or a conceptual exercise, but something that's very locatable in this present body. What's the actual experience in this moment of whatever's happening, feeling my breath, feeling this emotion, feeling this thought. And also to have this deep intention to see our souls very fully and very clearly, you know, not to hide parts. There's this concept called spiritual bypassing, where we tend to look at the aspiration of where practice, spiritual practice takes us as a way to skip over our stuff, our dysfunction, our pain. You know, we need to learn to fully inhabit our bodies, fully see the dark places of ourselves. We can't skip over our relationship with our bodies, the relationships with our minds and our emotions, into emptiness. The path is really through our bodies, through our minds, through our emotional and mental pain. This is really what the foundations of mindfulness point toward. So with this perspective of 18 years, looking back at this time in my life, I could see that this is really a reframing from going from resistance to non-resistance, or going from identification to non-identification. This movement of being really contracted and identified, you know, very restricted, to this more open relationship to myself, to others, to life itself. So identification, and what do we mean by that? When we're identified, it often feels a sense of resistance with what's occurring in our life. We don't like how things are going, we want things to be different. There's a sense of mental qualities, we're often thinking quite a bit about it, you know, emotional expression. You know, just take a survey of your typical thoughts to see how much resistance there is to the moment's experience. We see in areas where we get mad, we get scared, what pushes our buttons. When we take things as what they mean about me, what about you? You know, the self-defining thoughts and believing in those self-defining thoughts. And so the more we believe something, the more likely we're to resist it. You know, when we think it means something about us, about our failings or our successes. And so the Dharma is really a radical turning toward the same process. Normal way of dealing with conflict, avoiding blaming, avoiding, fighting with conflict, overcoming it. These are patterns of criticism, of judgment, of control, perfectionism, self-judgment, self-control. Instead, with the Dharma, we have this profound turning toward the difficult, without trying to change it or alter it, but to understand it. A really profound way of saying yes to our present moment's experience. So as we turn toward the difficult, we start to relax with it. We start to allow it to have its own voice. And we, in that turning toward it and relaxing, we start to see it more clearly. We start to develop this deep sense that the only way to fully understand and end suffering is to fully understand it. The only way to understand it is to turn toward it. Now, as we start to turn toward the difficult, two qualities can be very helpful. One of surrender, other than one of seeing clearly. So surrendering to this moment, to this moment's experience. We can also reframe it as relaxing into it, allowing things to be as they are. A sense of compassion, movement of the heart coming forth. And when we start to surrender to the moment's experience, we're moving away from our story around it, our ideas around it. That often keeps us very caught in that restriction and that struggle, the difficulty. So surrendering also takes a willingness to trust, and to trust that if I open to this, if I release my need to control, to influence, that something bad won't happen, that I can actually relax my control, actually relax into the stillness. Even surrendering the need to know, to identify, to name. Because before we know something, before we label it as this is so-and-so, this is this object, there's a direct experiencing of it. So surrendering. And then clear seeing is also vitally important. It's learning to see without an agenda, without trying to have an expectation of how things should be. So in this willingness to see some of our deeply held, most closely held beliefs, the ones that we're ashamed of, the ones that we judge, the ones that we're unconscious of. And the seeing allows wisdom to start to grow. In this process of seeing something clearly, insights start to arise from that. But staying focused on just seeing, we can sometimes get stuck because there's a way we can become subtly identified with the seer or the watcher. So even surrendering into that, being willing to have no distance between ourselves and what's being seen. And as we surrender, it starts to create more quiet. And in that quiet, there's a deeper seeing that arises. So we start to see that only by fully surrendering can we, to what's being seen. We can only fully see if we surrender fully to what's being seen. Otherwise, there's still a distance. But full surrender is a little scary. And it's a little bit of, there's a little apprehension about letting go of these patterns of control, of safety. So seeing helps us to understand that this is inherently a safe scenario, that we can relax into the moment's experience. We can start to see the limitations of our normal patterns of restriction, see the ways we create suffering. So we learn to surrender so we can see, and we see so we can surrender. And when these come together, then we find that there's nothing that's held outside of our heart. We also don't hold ourselves out of anything. So this very way of approaching the difficult in our life is critical for how the Dharma works in our life. So we start to relate to the difficult not as something to overcome or to fix, to avoid, but turn toward it with a sense of wanting to see it fully, to understand it, to surrender to it. We're starting to align ourselves with the first noble truth, right? The noble truth of dukkha. So dukkha is often translated as a suffering, but you can also think of it as this quality of unsatisfactoriness, the sense of rub or friction with experience. And so let's look at these aspects of the dukkha. There's three qualities of dukkha that the Buddha spoke about in the first noble truth. Looking at them through this lens of surrendering and also seeing clearly, and also seeing how this is really a movement from resistance to non-resistance, a movement from identification to non-identification. So the first type of dukkha is because of the dukkha of pain or the dukkha of loss. Now, having a human body means that we'll experience pain. You know, having a human heart means we'll experience loss, we'll experience grief when those we hold dear are taken away from us. This is the pain that everyone experiences. If you stub your toe, the loss of a dear one, sickness. Even the Buddha experienced suffering like this in his life. He had a bad back, he had dysentery, and he digestive issues, and he also, when his two chief disciples died, he said, like, it felt like the light had gone out of the world. So even the Buddha, we sometimes project as being beyond being human, but this quality of dukkha also applied to him, this loss of his friends. So when this type of dukkha is present in our life, much of the practice is learning to fully turn toward it, to fully relax into it, to allow it to be just as it is. Because it's hard not to see this basic fact of this dukkha, when this situation. When my wife said, I want a divorce, it's hard to avoid that fact. The seeing is there. It's the work of surrendering into it, opening to it. So much of our practice is learning to reconnect with this basic level, this core level of dukkha. And much of our mind activity, much of our agitation is based on trying to avoid this basic level of dukkha. Have you ever noticed when you come back lost from thought that your body welcomes you with a knee pain or an ache that you escaped into thought to try to avoid? So this is a very simple relationship to this first noble truth, this noble truth of dukkha. Just turning toward the difficult with a very simplistic way. When I was going through a divorce, one of my friends, also a teacher from a different tradition, said, just try to look at the immensity of the grief, of the sadness. Do not try to hold it in a personal way, but just see how vast it is. And I would just look out into nature, look upon a horizon, and just let the grief paint that whole area. And so when grief is really taken hold of us, having that sense of expanding it, allowing it to spread as far as it can. So it's not a personal grief, but it's a grief of being human. And that lightens the load, makes it easier to bear. So a few years ago, I was teaching a beginning class, and a woman kept raising her hand each class and asking a similar question. I was talking about this same concept of relaxing with what is, releasing a resistance to an experience. And she said, does this work for everything? And I said, yeah, you know, it works for your breath and your body and difficult emotions. And she kept raising her hand night after night. So finally I talked to her in private in an interview, and it turned out her mother had just died. And so she was hearing this instructions of turning toward the difficult, relaxing with it. And she was trying to hold that with this great loss in one of her deepest relationships in her life. And I realized that it's really important to see the timing of turning toward. You know, sometimes turning away is what's needed when grief happens. You know, working with grief in a very skillful way. And sometimes we feel like we're failing because we're experiencing suffering in our life. We have this idea that if I was a good meditator, I wouldn't feel any heartache, I wouldn't feel any pain, I wouldn't get sick, and everything would be just good, right? Everything would be smooth sailing, right? So ask, would most people feel pain? Would most people feel hurt or suffering with this? The physicality of pain, getting an injury or profound loss. And so give yourself this reality that life does have these pains that go through us. And with this first aspect of dukkha, the body is really an important refuge. Learning to find a place in the body that's comfortable, if you have chronic pain, for example, or if it's an emotional pain, finding a way of grounding in the body's reality to help change the contracted perspective of thought and of identification of I into this embodiment. So this is the dukkha of pain, of loss. The next type of dukkha is that of change, the dukkha of change. And I just like to think of this as the argument with the way things are, dukkha, right? Because life is always in a state of flux. It's always changing. I mean, can you think of one thing that's permanent, that one thing that's unchanging? You know, we see our thoughts are always in flux. Even things like this building is always changing. We can't see it because of the perspective, the time perspective. But if we look closely, we could see that things are always in a state of flux, arising and passing away. So when we take something as being permanent, as being fixed, when it's really not, then we experience suffering. So this is this quality of dukkha. So when we argue with this reality, we experience suffering, we experience this difficulty. And we act from that belief. Now in our life we have certain unarguables. And there's four that each one of us, no matter what we do, will age. Each one of us will experience illness. Each one of us will experience death. And each one of us, no matter what we do, no matter how much we cherish something, it would eventually be taken away from us. So these are the unarguables of life, that these will happen no matter what we do. So we have a choice of aligning ourselves with that or fighting that, this difficulty. So clearly seeing is really important, to see that this is the nature of life, that it comes and goes. At the same time, surrendering to that. And not only surrendering to the fact that things are coming and going, but also surrendering to the fact that we are coming and going. The sense of who you are is always in flux, is always changing. Not holding ourselves outside this law of impermanence. So this is the dukkha of change. And the third type of dukkha is the dukkha of reactivity. Okay. So a few years ago, I was on a retreat and experienced a kidney stone for the first time. And on the retreat, you know, there's certain levels of stability of mind and ability to hold the difficult. And I didn't know what it was. I just thought I ate something funny for a while. And I was just relaxing with the experience, and even though it was quite intense, I would just keep relaxing, and a few days went by to the point it got too much to hold. Went to the hospital and got a CAT scan and turned to be a kidney stone. So even though it was a very intense, very physically intense, very painful experience, it was still workable. I could still relate to it. But then a few months later, I had a second stone, a second attack of this kidney stone. And so even though the physical pain was a lot less relative, it wasn't as bad, it was much more overwhelming because I remembered, oh, this lasted for 10 days and I was in this much pain and it cost this much to go to the hospital. And so I built this whole story around this simple experience. So this dukkha of reactivity is this adding to our experience, how we build this bigger and bigger world of worry, of fretting. And so you can see how this reactivity, we apply it to these first two types of dukkha. The dukkha of ordinary pain, that we add something to it. We add our sense of resistance, not wanting, our projections into the future based on the past. Right? And the dukkha of change, wanting to keep something perfect. You know, this moment's perfect, I don't want it to change. And so in this category of dukkha, this is where the vast majority of our suffering occurs. You know, our emotional pain, our mental anguish, our fighting, not being understood, being judged. But yet the good news is that this is the dukkha that in particularly is the most optional, the most aspect of dukkha that the Buddha most focused on in terms of the releasing of our suffering, understanding how we can relate to our experience without having to add something to it, without having to build this resistance to it. This is simply surrendering to this moment's experience when pain arises, simply relaxing, allowing, and connecting with the body. Again, you know, this when we find ourselves really caught in reactivity, the body is a great refuge to come back to. You know, where's the breath in this moment? Where's the body sensation in this moment? And in that way, it aligns us into the present moment instead of the fears and the thoughts, which can be very overwhelming, very beyond our control. Now, the other aspect, if you look at this third dukkha, the dukkha of reactivity, is this clear seeing, be able to really investigate it. Now, as we form the thought turning toward the difficult, it's interesting to see what's the energy that we're bringing into that. You know, how are we approaching that? Because often there's a hidden agenda of wanting to fix it, wanting to control it. I turn toward the difficult in order to overcome it, to not have any more of the difficult. So there's this agenda to fix or control. And this reveals these deeper patterns in our life of controlling and fixing life. If you look at this whole idea of trying to control life and trying to fix life, and we really get very quiet with it. You know, there's the superficialness we often get so focused on, that how am I going to, you know, have my wife do a certain thing, or my daughter do a certain thing, or have the traffic do a certain thing. These are the details of life. Or how am I going to change myself? If we start to go below the level of the superficialness of it, the concept level of it, and a deeper quality to it, we start to see there's this deep, almost hunger or fear that drives us to want to control. And if we become even more still with it, we see how the sense of me, the sense of self really orients around trying to control, trying to influence life, to have this sense of taking this life, because it's very disorienting how much things are always in flux, always changing. The sense of self wants to find a place of stability. That's why it keeps reproducing itself, reproducing its influence and its control moment after moment. And so to really investigate the sense of self is to turn toward it and with this quality of again, seeing clearly and also relaxing deeply. So you start to feel that need to want to influence, to want to control. And so at that point, then there may be some fear or some worry comes up as you start to come into that seeing of, if I let go of my control, will life take care of itself? Can life manage without my influence? Right? And then if you surrender into that, if you relax into it, then you can see there's a deeper peace as you do release your control. And there's a simple relationship that you're simply being with life and life is being. It's a simple process that comes and goes. A lot of it boils down to our argument with the moment's experience. And that we want life to be a different way. We can frame that as resistance. We can frame that as struggle. And as we want life to be different, as we argue with it, we also guarantee a place for our sense of self to be established, that we really ground into that. In fact, it's a requirement. You know, if we argue with reality, we have to have the person who's arguing. And so here where it gets a little more slippery is that we want to release the argument with reality, including the fact that we're arguing with reality. Right? So an argument's coming up, I don't like how this is going, I wish this was different. Instead of trying to bypass that pain and skip over it, say, okay, this is the reality of the moment. I'm full of argument. My mind wants it to be different than it is. My body wants it. I'm really upset about this. Because this argument is something that's very valuable. It actually reveals this, it's like a clue into how you make yourself, how you create yourself. It's a little bit like if you were an archaeologist and you're uncovering a dinosaur skeleton, right? So you come across, you're uncovering some dirt and you find a bone. If you just grab that bone and picked it up and said, I found a bone, you will lose the connection with the other bones and the relationship of where that dinosaur lived that's revealed in the sentiment that it covers it. So same thing with our sense of self, or a sense of difficulty. If we have a difficulty and we just quickly grab it and try to fix it, it's like grabbing that one bone. And we lose this whole concept, this whole gift of seeing this whole piece, how everything's interconnected, how our argument is just the tip of the iceberg. So we start to see that the difficult becomes this gift that we can actually turn toward, that we can actually use as a way to understand ourselves. Gurdjieff, who was a Russian mystic and spiritual teacher, he had a community of people who would practice. And then there was one person who was very difficult. Everybody hated him. He just rubbed everybody raw. And finally, one day, this man left. And Gurdjieff ran after him and said, please come back, you know, because your rub is what gives people the impetus for spiritual growth. Because if life was too easy, was too simple, what would be the impetus to change, to look? So back when I had this divorce, it was like there was this ripeness. You know, I had this understanding of non-resistance through Aikido. I had this intention to look deeply. And then the divorce happened, okay? This incredible pain, this heartbreaking pain. And then I hear this Dharma, turning toward the pain, turning toward your resistance. So that difficulty gave the rightness for everything to come together in a very, very tangible, very, very meaningful way for me. It's like we can, the sense of self and the sense of who we are, the subconscious is often very, it is unconscious. It's hard to see what it is. If you've ever seen one of those movies where some character becomes invisible or is invisible or some creature is invisible, so you can't see the actual person, but you can see their actions. You can see the cup moving through the air. So that's almost how these deep patterns are, that we can't see them directly at first, but we can see the actions of them. We can see how we speak, how we act, how we think, especially around patterns of difficulty. What comes up with us when our wife says something we don't like, when we struggle with something, what comes up in our minds? So this is like seeing this invisible creature moving. So instead of jumping and trying to get that cup down, we actually, okay, can I observe it? Can I see the outline of it? Then it's almost like we take flour or paint and we start to spread it on the invisible creature. We start to see the outline of it. It starts to be revealed to us by being very patient. You know, another metaphor I often like is if you go into the woods, as we go into the woods, all the creatures run away from you because we're noisy and loud and smell funny. But if you go and sit stead quietly for an hour or so, nature starts to come back around us and the shy creatures start to come out and investigate. The same thing with these patterns of ourselves is we start to develop this much lighter hand. Instead of like judging and seeing, trying to fix it, that's very heavy-handed. We start to become more subtle, more quiet with our intention, with our eyes, with our awareness. So we're starting to see, oh, here's this little swirl that represents this deep pattern of resentment. Okay, and what is the resentment? You know, it leads back to these childhood patterns, perhaps. But I can see even below those, below the childhood patterns, there's also this mechanism of how I glue myself together. And in doing so, we're going from identification to non-identification, from resistance to non-resistance. And so with surrender and clear seeing, we start to really value the difficult. And partly what happens is the difficult becomes more manageable. Because instead of waiting until when we were divorced, until waiting that we have a terminal diagnosis, that we've lost a loved one, we start to work with the difficult on much more day-to-day levels. We become much more sensitive to that. Noticing this subtle contraction when your son or your daughter or your parent says something to you, or when your loved one says something to you that strikes you wrong, that pushes your button. You start to be able to turn toward that in a very spacious way. You don't have to wait for the deep, the really profound ones. So in this way, dukkha becomes noble because it leads to the end of suffering. And always remember that it's not a one noble truth tradition. There's four noble truths. There's the noble truth of dukkha, the cause of dukkha, the end of dukkha, and the path to the end of dukkha. So everyone in this room has had some insights into this movement from identification to non-identification, from resistance to non-resistance. If you're brand new to meditation, just starting off, just learning how to connect with your breath, connect with your body sensations in a very simple way, learning to release the thinking mind, the obsessive mind a little bit, even a little bit, that's that movement. And if you've been practicing for many years, learning how to release the thinking mind and connect with the body is very helpful. And starting to see these assumptions that we hold so dear, that we assume to be true, questioning them, seeing that maybe they're not true. And there's more space that comes again and again as we go from contracted to expansion, going from identification to non-identification, going from resistance to non-resistance. So this does require a lot of patience and a lot of fortitude. Because often we see an aspect of ourselves, how we contract around a certain pattern. And we think we see it, and okay, I'm done with that. And then our sister or our brother or our kid, our parents say something to us. And they know just how to push that right button, right? And that pattern comes right back up. It's like, I thought I was done with this. I thought I was finished with this. But it comes back, right? So the Buddha, the night of the Buddha decided to become, he had full commitment to awaken. As you know the story, he sat underneath the Bodhi tree and had this deep commitment that I will not move until I experience full awakening or I die, whichever comes first. And so with that deep commitment, he sat there. And in Buddhist mythology, there's the embodiment of delusion, of greed, of hatred that comes up, of the hindrances called Mara. So Mara is this embodiment of these qualities. And so Mara assaulted the Buddha to try to get him off this path. So through armies of terrible creatures at him, try to seduce him with beautiful visions. And they finally even questioned, what right do you have to be here? And the Buddha touched the ground and said, by the right of the earth be my witness. So in that moment, the Buddha became awakened by really directly confronting these qualities of delusion, of greed, of hatred. And so I often thought that, okay, that's great, the Buddha is done with Mara. Right? But actually, if you look at the suttas, Mara kind of followed the Buddha around for many years, you know, for at least 7 years. He would show up in different disguises and trying to trick the Buddha, try to get the Buddha back into his areas of dysfunction. So you can think of the people who can push your buttons as Mara coming up. You know, okay? So you think, I'm done with this, okay, they're pushing my button again. So eventually the Buddha would realize what was going on, and he wouldn't fight against Mara, wouldn't try to combat him. He would simply say, "I see you, Mara. I see you." And when Mara realized he was seen, he'd become discouraged and vanish. And so that's the simple power of seeing, to be able to see very clearly. And the Buddha also talked about, when we look at an insight arises, there's these three levels of knowledge around it, three embodiments of it. The first is this almost superficial knowledge, almost an intellectual understanding. You can take it like the sense of impermanence, the characteristic of impermanence, or of dukkha, or of non-self. We can have this intellectual understanding of it, kind of be able to have some way of working with it. That's mostly just from a hearing it standpoint. That's how I start off my practice, is hearing suffering is caused by my resistance to my experience. But it was an intellectual thing that I found very fascinating. It felt very true. But at the same time, it was very fairly superficial. And the next knowledge, or next level, is one of direct knowing, knowing for yourself. So over the years, I started in this sense of, this is really what resistance feels like. I remember, you know, on a retreat, you know, Rodney would often talk about resistance and non-resistance, relaxing with experience. And so at first I would be like feeling so much pain in my body, okay, I'm going to relax with this pain, and it was a lot of struggle to try and relax, right? But eventually I started to be much softer with it. I remember at one point on a retreat at Cloud Mountain, feeling this deep sense of release, this deep sense, okay, this is what true relaxing means. And feeling the pain of how much resistance I've had through my life. And it just keeps going. You just get more and more subtle with relaxing with the moment. So this is a level of embodiment, or this is a level of direct knowing for yourself, what this insight might be, whatever it might be. But the final level is one of embodiment. So you know it so deeply that your actions naturally start to flow from that knowledge, from that insight. So it becomes the only way that makes sense. And so this quality of embodiment is really essential for our practices, because we can have very deep insights on retreats or in life, but until we bring that forth into our daily lives, until we really test it and see how am I with my difficult people, with my difficult situations, with my difficult mind, where is the insight right now? Where is it in this moment? So I'd like to give you some homework to work with this. So in a few days, many of you will be celebrating Thanksgiving. All right. So Thanksgiving, you probably have your favorite aunt always brings her famous baked beans, and your mom brings her famous mashed potatoes, and your son brings their apple pie, right? But they also bring another dish. You know, they bring the dish, the unconscious dish. Your aunt brings her passive-aggressive dish, right? And your mom brings her passivity, and your dad brings his aggression or his judgment. And your sister brings her buttons that she knows just how to push, right? So as you start that Thanksgiving feast, you know, realize there's two feasts going on. You know, and how much you want to. You know, if you're like me, you tend to overeat. You're like, okay. But we also overeat with this other feast, you know, of dysfunction, of our family of origin, often in really is kind of the mother load of dysfunction, right? Where our buttons are really created, right? So we can look at it as something, oh, my sister's doing her stuff again, I can't believe that. Okay, so embody your insights. If your insight is that if I get lost in thought, I suffer more. If I connect with my body, I feel more grounded. That's a beautiful insight. Okay, so can I connect with my body in the midst of my sister doing her usual stuff that she's done for the last decades? All right, and see what that's like. You know, if you have different insights of seeing how the sense of self forms in a relationship, see that. Okay, how is my sense of self forming? And can I choose a different way of being? Can I choose a different way of interacting than my normal habitual way? Because if we keep doing habitual ways, we keep reinforcing our old patterns, our old ignorance. But if we embody our insights, then it starts to really undercut these patterns. Then the difficulty starts to become something that you actually look forward to. Okay, how am I going to be in this situation? What's going to arise in me that I can look at? Can I turn toward with quiet, with stillness, with the willingness to see? So your homework is to embody your insights, to surrender as deeply as you can, to see as clearly as you can, to see if there can be some quality of movement from resistance to non-resistance. So you notice, what do you keep out of your heart? And what do you hold outside of your heart? And bringing those aspects back in. So you find that you hold nothing outside of your heart. And at the same time, you hold your heart outside of nothing. You don't hold your heart out of anything. All right, let's just sit quietly for a few moments. Okay, we have some space for some comments or questions about this talk or about your practice, about Thanksgiving. Oh yes, Moffat. Yes. Yeah, so the comment is not quite understanding how life will take care of itself without my influence. And my influence is needed to keep things from falling apart, from being disastrous. And that's something I didn't talk about, but there is this paradox between our skillful actions and our relationship to the moment. And so often what happens is, the way I approached this evening was this moment-by-moment relationship to experience. Okay, can we learn to connect with our experience without reactivity, without trying to change this moment's experience, the actual physical manifestation right in this moment? But that doesn't discount in any way how we act in the world. In fact, it allows our actions to be much more skillful, much more helpful. Because if we don't allow ourselves just to relax with the moment, we often don't see the whole picture. You know, we just see what we're reacting to. You know, we don't see the other side of the story, we don't see the agenda, we don't see our own pattern, what our mind is. Maybe we're tired or irritated, so we tend to bias toward the irritation. So if we can relax with the moment, we can start to see this whole pattern. And then from that full seeing and that full relaxing, then the right action just naturally tends to come forth. And certainly there's many things in my life will fall apart if I don't keep adding some stuff into it, you know, some skillful actions and tweaking it and working with it and going in the right direction. So it's not discounting any of that, but learning how to have this moment by moment relaxing with the moment without trying to change it or alter it. And then from there, seeing what's the right action. You know, so like a very blatant example is if you're standing in the road and you're seeing a car coming toward you, you know, okay, I'm just going to relax and assume it's going to work out. There's, you know, you move out of the way. So there's a sense of spontaneity that you start to trust more and more. But until that spontaneity starts to move through you, you just become a vehicle for it, there's this discernment that starts to get more clear. You start to really own yourself. So yeah, it's interesting coming into this role as a teacher. Sometimes I watch my mind, like what is going through my mind? You know, like, okay, am I being liked? Am I doing this well? And just seeing the pattern of that. If I'm not conscious to that thought that comes up, then I'm going to tend to act from it. I can say, okay, there's just this sense of insecurity or this sense of doubt that comes up. And there's also another stability that I can listen to, I can focus on. Thank you, Martha. Yes.
Reflection on what you said around sometimes this hopeful thing is to turn away and not towards.
Right.
And I tend to have an obsessive mind, and I was sitting here meditating, and that something came up that was like emotionally painful, then I became physically painful, pain, and I was just like, man, this sucks. I gotta start thinking about something else.
Yeah.
And I was just sort of like turned my attention to something else, and I think I just struggle a lot with like that subtlety, like when is it appropriate to sort of like be with versus like,
right,
this is not the time to be, for whatever reason, whatever space I'm in, to be thinking about this.
So the question is about this sense of discernment about when is it good to look into it, to turn toward it, versus when is it time to shift your attention. And so that's part of the art of meditation, is that you start to develop this sense of, you know, how tense is my mind? How tense is my body? You know, so you can frame it, this movement, this process, this practice is from going from tension to ease, from restriction to non-restriction. Right? So you always come back to that. So we often hear the instructions, and depending on what, you know, our nature of our relationship to what's arising, sometimes we're like a dog with a sock. We don't want to let go, and we just get tighter and tighter around it. Okay, so when you start to notice that sense of tightness, it's like you have to be subtle enough to be able to see, how am I relating to this experience? How am I relating to my mind? What is the shape of my mind? What's the shape of my body in this context? All right. So, if I'm relaxing with it, and so part of it is learning this taste of non-identification, of release, of softening, and once you start to really get a flavor of that, you start to really get to sense this sense of tension of becoming more restricted, and so there's this quality of discernment, and it's really wise effort is this sense of discernment and knowing, where do we put our energy? So when you find yourself, an emotion comes up and you turn toward it and you just get more and more tight, you start to find your mind gets more agitated. It's like, oh wait, this is going the wrong direction, right? Okay, so what's called for? You know, maybe opening the eyes, opening to sound, you know, just feeling the body as a whole. So going more expansion. So it's a really good question, because each one of us, there's going to be things that we're going to tend to naturally turn away from because we don't want to face it. And so then the task is learning to connect with it. But there's also things that we turn too much toward that we get really caught in, we get really tight around. And so then the task is to learn to soften around it, to not be so caught in it. And then it starts to balance out, that it becomes more obvious what's going on. But just like the Mara and the Buddha, you know, they'll come up and you get trapped and get caught in something, and then you realize, oh, I'm going the wrong way. Right? Does that make sense? Welcome. And meditation is not a one size fits all. We teach it in that way, in a lot of ways. Okay, you connect with your breath, your body, your emotions in the body. It's, you know, vedanas, you know, feeling tone. We go through these different categories of experience. But for some people, connecting with the body as an initial instruction is too much, you know, based on their past history. If they've had a history of abuse or trauma, connecting with the body is overwhelming. So learning to have this sense of expansiveness. But yet if we get too expansive, sometimes we get so lost in thought, we don't know where we are. So learning to find this sense of one-pointedness, this grounding on one in our body or grounding on our breath, or this one aspect of our experience is needed. So it's this beautiful art that it does take a while to get the knack of it. You know, it's like balancing on a bike, leaning too much this way, leaning too much that way. And so your questions help fine-tune it. I mean, ideally, we would teach each person individually, you know, what's needed in your mind in this moment, till you can learn that for yourself, you know, what's needed in my experience. Yes, Jenny. Yes.
And I was able to go a little bit deeper, and then I needed to be held, so I literally put a blanket around me and held me tight. So I did these things in real small baby steps, because in the past I would just will myself right through, and I would never get there. And now I'm taking tiny little steps, and I'm backing off until my body is calmer, and then I can go a little farther. There's a dance in there that I'm going to trust my body and back off until it's ready, but also be present enough and willing enough to go that little extra step.
Yes, good, beautiful. And that's nicely said. If we couldn't hear, she was talking about having some difficulty coming out, that had a lot of tightness in the chest. And in the past, she would have gone just kind of full bore into it, diving into it, and then wouldn't get anywhere. Things would tighten up or be overwhelming. And now she's learned how to go just baby steps. And what I heard is this nice quality of this intention to turn toward, but there's also this awareness of how am I relating to that turning toward. Okay, so sometimes we just think, I'm going to just turn toward, you know, I don't care what happens, the consequences. But there's this compassion that's needed, and this deep caring for yourself. So as you turn toward, you're also noticing, tracking, okay, there's a tension in the body. What's the body need to help stabilize with this seeing? So you can see there's a little bit of seeing, a little bit of surrendering, and then there's a stabilizing as you relaxed into that. You know, comforted yourself, soothed yourself. Okay, now I can relax a little bit more. And that's a very... This process should feel gentle. You know, it should feel like it's very friendly toward yourself. If it doesn't feel friendly, just step back and look at how the mind is. Because so many of us have this tendency to self-judge, to be very critical of ourselves. And that's unseen. It really shapes how we approach life. So it colors it. Colors are very relationship to the difficult. But that sense of self-judgment, things, parts of us high, we tense up around. I mean, think of it, if you had a friend or, you know, someone that you held in a lot of respect, and you started to tell them something that was very dear to you, and they quickly jumped in and told you how to fix it or started to judge you, or, you know, how much would you share? You would kind of close up. Okay? And so often for ourselves, we do the same thing. We start to see some aspect of ourselves and we quickly rush in to judge it, to try to fix it, to control it. And then that part closes up. But as Jenny was saying, learning this quality of listening very tenderly to herself, you know, what's needed in this moment, at the same time having this movement toward the edge, toward the leading edge. Now, this is nicely said. Thank you. Yes. Yes, it's a tough one. Is like when the question is, when do I, with a very difficult, very volatile relationship, when's the right time to turn toward it, and when's the right time to turn away from it? And when is it overwhelming? Or when is it even damaging to ourselves, or punishing ourselves in that? And unfortunately, a lot of it is trial and error. You know, you say, okay, I went too far that way. I stayed too long. I have a colleague who would go back to visit his family, and he would always do 5 days. And he realized, after 3 days, I would change my plane ticket and leave. So he just set for, I'm going to come for 3 days. And he realized that was his tolerance, you know, because it just, especially if there's only one person who's really being conscious and paying attention, and then one's still really acting out, especially if they're acting out in with substance abuse and these deep patterns, even not even substance abuse, just these deep dysfunctional patterns, it can be very hard to stay with. So you give yourself a little bit, you know, into it, and you come back, and I'll kind of titrate my exposure. But use each exposure each time you relate to that person and see what gets triggered. So even as someone who's passed away, you can still do so much work around that. You see, because this person who triggers you, they may very well have things that they're not doing very skillfully, that's unkind, that's based in harm, right? But there's other aspects which really are how you take it, how you hook into it. And so it's like, okay, how can I understand about myself? I mean, just this year, I've spent a lot of time being triggered around someone and feeling the reactivity. It's like, okay, coming back to this, to myself, taking full responsibility. In fact, at one point, I was kind of imagining this person I was being reactive to, and I said, okay, what does this person look like in my mind's eye? And I had this image of this demon with horns, when I interact with this person, I said, this isn't this person at all. You know, it's not even, you know, the family origin piece that gets triggered. It's this kind of archetype almost. And then I realized, okay, this is what I'm adding to this. And so then I started to loosen up around it. So that gave me a much more potential for skillful action. But when I'm caught in it, I have very limited options. Like, you know, fight, flee, free, or freeze, you know, basically. Okay, but if I'm able to really explore it and work with it, then when I talk with this person, interact with them, I can be really familiar with, okay, this is being triggered. I don't have to add more to that. And I can actually listen. I can actually listen to the pain that's underneath that person, that's driving their behavior. Yeah, but it's a trial process, trial and error. Okay, so thank you.